It's Wednesday, November 20th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your look at news from around the state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Coming up, we'll look back at what we can learn from the Blue Bear Ponzi scheme.
But first, this week, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, or COGCC, is meeting to vote on new rules to regulate flow lines. Flow lines are the underground pipelines that connect oil and gas wells to storage tanks. Yesterday, we spoke with Director of the Commission, Jeff Robbins, ahead of a public hearing in Greeley. KUNC's Matt Bloom was at that meeting and joins us now to update us on what happened. Hey, Matt.
Hey.
So remind our listeners, what is the commission considering?
There's two big issues to think about here. There's mapping flow lines. This is one of the more thornier issues that they're talking about. It's asking whether we should be able to zoom in on a public map and see if there's a flow line running by your house or your school or where you work. And then there's the issue of abandoning these lines. Should we have to dig them up out of the ground once they're cut off from oil and gas wells, or can we leave them there? Some of the questions being tossed around today are really, really detailed questions, like how close should people be able to zoom into these maps? There's a little bit of disagreement about how close that should be. And there's a lot of attention around this hearing because it's the first big rule change at the COGCC since Senate Bill 181 passed earlier this year. What it does is basically shift this agency's priority to protecting public health and safety above fostering the oil and gas industry. So we're hearing those words, public health and safety, tossed around a lot.
So last night, the commission held a meeting to hear public comments on those rules here in Greeley. What did residents have to say?
Christine Nieholm was a concerned resident from Adams County, and she got up and held this big poster that showed these corroded pipes stacked up in a field. She said that they were found near a neighborhood near her house and that they weren't properly abandoned.
My simple message is that picture paints a thousand words. To protect public health, transparency is a must. Mapping is not going to ban oil and gas in Colorado. It's simply a matter of protecting the public.
There's an overall sense from residents that we should have a map of these lines that people can look at and understand if there's a line in their neighborhood. I'd say that the room wasn't packed by any means, but the people who were there were really, really engaged in this issue.
And of course, some of the people in that room, industry experts, what did we hear from them?
It's a mixed bag. Some support these changes. They say that, hey, we want to make this as safe as possible, but there is disagreement about how detailed these maps should be. There's some safety concerns around that. Cody Doan spoke about the general sense of overregulation that this industry is feeling right now. He works for Halliburton, which laid off a couple hundred people from its Grand Junction office last month, partly due to lower oil prices in the market, but also because of the regulatory uncertainty in Colorado.
They don't know where the next house payment's coming from. They don't know how they're going to make ends meet. And a lot of that is just because of that financial insecurity that's happening because of the lengthy process and over-regulating something that's already working.
Of course, some people would disagree and say things aren't working right now. But the biggest example, obviously, is the Firestone explosion in 2017. But Doan says that we should think twice before changing the whole system because of one tragedy. Mm.
And when can we expect the commission to vote on whether or not to adopt these new rules?
Once they hear all public testimony and finish their deliberations, which right now it's looking like Friday.
Matt Bloom is a reporter for KUNC. He's been doing a lot of reporting on this, and all of it is available on our website, KUNC.org. Matt, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Matt mentioned a 2017 explosion shaping the conversation around flow lines. Now we're going to talk to a survivor from that incident.
Erin Martinez will testify tomorrow in front of the COGCC about the proposed rule changes to flow lines. She is a survivor of that explosion, which federal investigators determined was caused by a severed pipeline near her home. It resulted in the death of her husband and her brother. Erin joins us now to discuss her testimony. Erin, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thank you for having me.
You are testifying in front of the commission on Thursday. What message are you hoping to send to the commissioners and other people there?
Honestly, from the beginning, I'm just trying to make my story not become someone else's reality. And so I am advocating and pushing for change that would keep something like this from happening to someone again.
Of course, they're considering new rules that would require things like mapping of flow lines, more testing on existing lines, and requirements for what to do when abandoning those lines. What do you think about the proposed rules? Are they enough?
I think that, you know, there were several circumstances that led to my home explosion, and I would really like to see a bunch of rules and regulations put in place that would keep something like that from happening again. And specifically, you know, the line that leaked gas into our basement was not properly abandoned. It was left connected to the well. And so I'm really pushing for things that are going to be left in the ground, such as abandoned pipelines and flow lines, that they be removed. When they're removed, it's pretty hard for them to be a conduit for gas to travel through them, and an explosion can occur. I'm also pushing for disclosure. I think that the public should be allowed to know what is in and around where they are purchasing their homes or where they're working or they're sending their kids to school. Specifically, flow line information has never been shared with the public. And we had a flow line that was 6 feet from the perimeter of our house. And, you know, that is something that we should have known about. Also pushing for inspections. I feel like when wells change ownership between companies, there should be an inspection done in order for you to know what you are now liable for.
Right.
Had there been an inspection in the 5 times that that well changed hands behind our house, someone would have found that that flow line was still connected to the well. And quite frankly, I wouldn't be here telling you my story right now. And, you know, finally, I'm just really pushing for when a well has been a shut-in well and it gets reactivated, you know, that notice be sent to the people that are around that well. And in addition, they do some sort of an inspection and pressure checking before they put that well back online.
It's taken a little while to get to this point, more than 2 years for these rules to be considered by the COGCC. What are your thoughts on why it has taken this long?
It's a frustrating process, obviously, when the explosion happened and, you know, we discovered the reasons for why it happened. You want things to be changed immediately. And, you know, there were some additions to the flow line rules that were made. There were some changes to the 811. But there really wasn't any concrete things that were done in order to prevent something like this from happening. And, you know, 181 was passed, and it opened up the door to be able to make these changes and write these regulations. And as much as I would have loved for it to happen immediately, you know, I'm just thankful that we are finally in a position where, you know, we can make these changes and that we can try to prevent something like this from happening again.
The Denver Post reported that you recently moved and then discovered a flow line near your new home. Is that right?
We actually didn't discover a flow line. We purchased, you know, a new house after the explosion. I needed a place for my children and I to kind of gain some stability. And my son had told me, you really need to make sure, Mom, that, you know, there's nothing around our house that can create something like this again. And I assured him that I was going to do that. And so I looked at the COGCC maps that were online. I talked to the town engineer and the development committee and, you know, even the builder. And I was assured that there was no oil and gas within the vicinity of my home. And about 6 months after we moved in, we saw Anadarko trucks in the field behind our house, and you could tell that they were digging and they were searching for something, and apparently they were trying to locate a plugged and abandoned well because they were going to start the second phase of construction behind our home, and they couldn't find it. You know, it was clear that they had no idea where it was at, and unfortunately, they kept getting closer and closer to my house, and it was discovered that it's in the property line that I share with my neighbor. And so basically, there's a plugged and abandoned well in our backyard, and the records showed no indication of that. Clearly, the town didn't know where it was at, and clearly neither did the oil and gas company. And so I'm not comfortable with a well in my backyard almost. And so we are in the process of moving again.
What went through your mind as you learned all of this?
First of all, I was very concerned that I had lost my son's trust. You know, I had with all the information that was available to me, I used it all. And I felt confident that it was accurate and that I was going to be able to move into this house and, you know, he was going to be safe, that something wasn't going to happen again. And, you know, obviously I was worried about that. And then I was just devastated by the fact that I basically did all you could do to figure out whether or not something of oil and gas was around your home. And I thought that I had done everything I could. And unfortunately, the information that was given to me wasn't accurate. And that's where it really started to push and tell me that something needs to be done about disclosure. Not only do we need to disclose, you know, what's in the ground, but it needs to be accurate. And we need to make sure that the things that we think are there, that they actually are there, that they've been disposed of properly. And that information needs to be made public so that we can all make informed decisions about what we want to live next to.
I wanted to ask you about advocacy as a part of your life now. You have said that you didn't ask for this role. What would you like people to know about your involvement?
I'm not out to try to destroy oil and gas. I'm not trying to promote that it, you know, that it doesn't happen in Colorado anymore. I realize that it's a big part of our daily lives and our economy, and I think that oil and gas can continue to do what they're doing in Colorado. I just think that they need to be held accountable for their actions, and I think that, you know, we all need to make sure that if it's going to be in and around where we're going to all live, that it's safe. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of regulations and things that need to be done in order for that to happen. And, I mean, yeah, I definitely never wanted this role, but I really feel that I know what it's been like for the last 2.5 years for my family and I, and I would never want to see another family have to go through this. And I think the best way to honor the memory of my husband, Mark, and my brother, Joey, is for something good to come out of this, and that good can be this change, and that, you know, we can make everyone in and around oil and gas safe, and we can prevent something like this from happening again.
Aaron Martinez, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
In 2009, a trust was established for victims of a massive financial scam which took place right here in northern Colorado. That scam is known as the Blue Bear Ponzi Scheme, named for the Windsor financial firm that defrauded investors out of millions of dollars. Now, 10 years later, that trust is running out, and those victims have received very little financial retribution. Meanwhile, no convictions have occurred as a result of the scheme.
So, what exactly happened, and what can this teach us about how Ponzi schemes work? Two reporters from BizWest are here to break down what happened, Dan Micah.
Hey, Henry.
And Lucas, hi.
Hi, Henry.
Lucas, let's start with you, and let's start with the basics. For people who weren't around for this scheme, or for perhaps the more popular Bernie Madoff story, what is a Ponzi scheme?
A Ponzi scheme is named after a con man from the early 20th century, Charles Ponzi, and in its simplest form, it's robbing Peter to pay Paul. So, it's an investment scheme that brings together a group of investors and then pays those investors using money raised from new investors. And then those new investors are paid with money raised from a third set of investors, and so on and so on.
Okay, so it's like a big chain, so to speak.
You got it.
How did the Blue Bear Ponzi scheme work?
The Blue Bear Ponzi scheme is interesting in that it revolves around a very specific type of financial vehicle called factoring, which essentially is the process of one company selling its accounts receivables to another. So let's say I'm the owner of Lucas's dairy supply company and I sell milk to grocery stores. And the main truck that I use to deliver my milk to those stores broke down and I need to buy a new one. I don't have a lot of cash on hand, but I do have invoices from 10 grocery stores who each owe me $10,000. So I go to Henry's factoring company and say, hey, Henry, will you pay me $80,000 and I'll give you all of these invoices? And now it's your job as the factoring company to go and collect, and anything on top of the $80,000 that you paid me is your profit.
How did Blue Bear actually use it, or how do they use it to their advantage?
Blue Bear started business, and it was actually when it first launched, it was using the name First American Factoring LLC, and that was back in 2003. And what it did is serve as sort of a general broker, a general sort of hub for a bunch of what they call IFCs, or independent factoring companies. And what those companies would do is they would go out and recruit investors with promises of, you know, really lofty returns of, you know, 12% to 15% based on, you know, these accounts receivables that they said they had. And, you know, that worked well for the investors for a little while, because these independent factoring companies that all sort of fed back into Blue Bear were bringing new investors on. But eventually these schemes stopped working, because the underlying product that they're selling the investors on, these accounts receivables, these invoices, are actually valueless. They're essentially worthless.
Let's talk about fallout now. Dan, I want to switch to you. How did this company really break apart?
The big reason that Blue Bear failed, and this is what we've gleaned from reading hundreds of pages of court documents over the years, is that originally Blue Bear had set up its books in a way that made it believe that no matter what would happen, whatever factoring account it bought, whatever invoice it had on hand, it would eventually be able to cash in that invoice and recoup the entire amount. Obviously, when you are in the debt collection business, sometimes that doesn't happen. In Blue Bear's case, it happened for the vast majority of the accounts that it had, but because of the way the books were set up, the investors and the people running the company were thinking this is a healthy company that is running very well, until I believe in 2004 an audit of the books re-ran the books in looking at what the cash was on hand and what the cash flow was, instead of just assuming all this money would come in. We've also heard tangentially that Blue Bear was also making side investments that it was not telling its investors about. For example, investing in a startup company, dabbling in real estate. So up until 2005, the company seemed to be doing well and seemed to be making a profit, until eventually, like Lucas said, that money just runs out and the whole thing falls apart.
Let's switch gears here. I want to talk about this trust that was established in 2009. Dan, how did that trust work?
In 2009, Blue Bear successfully left bankruptcy. And the idea there was for Blue Bear to try and get new investors and under court supervision and a new set of directors paying attention to the company, tried to become a healthy functioning company again. But as we now know, because the assets that this company thought it had in terms of these debts that it could collect basically were worthless, about a few months later, the directors of Blue Bear sent out a letter to the rest of the shareholders saying that Blue Bear was going to shut down and restart itself as Pelican Financial Services. Pelican would not be trying to collect any more accounts. It wouldn't try to be running as a business trying to make money. The only thing that Pelican would be doing was trying to collect any outstanding debts that Blue Bear had already had at that point, and also to try and recoup some judgments it had from the original runners of Blue Bear when it was first started. That was set up in 2009, and it was scheduled this year to close down and to have its final disbursements out.
Lucas, I'm wondering if you can explain what it means that this trust is running out this year.
It kind of it puts a period at the end of the sentence here. You know, this it sort of brings to a conclusion this entire Blue Bear saga.
Tell us about the human side of all this. What does this mean for the victims of the Ponzi scheme? I mean, were the victims just simply the investors, or were more people affected? And how much money did they end up receiving as a result of being victims?
There were more than 400 investors total that lost, you know, more than $20 million in this whole scheme. In terms of what each of the individual investors received back, you know, it sort of varies, but it's safe to say that it's really pennies on the dollar. I mean, you know, we talked to folks that have lost tens of thousands of dollars. There's some evidence that there you know, folks have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in this scheme. And the human aspect is important to us, because that's actually how we kind of started working on this story, is that we were approached by a couple of former investors who, you know, hadn't heard anything about the status of their case in years and years and years. And they came to us and said, "Do you guys know what's going on with Blue Bear?" And we said, "Well, no, I mean, we're familiar with what happened, you know, a decade or so ago, but, you know, we're not really sure where the case is now." So we just started to dig in. When we talked to these folks, they just want somebody to fill them in on where their case is and kind of give them some answers. And we're hoping to do that for them.
Dan, we'll switch over to you for one final question. But you two did so much reporting on this. I mean, looking through hundreds of pages of documents, what did you learn through your reporting about how difficult it is to catch these schemes?
I would use the words of Fred Joseph, the former Colorado Securities Commissioner. I spoke to him about this case, and while he didn't remember any of the specifics about Blue Bear, he put it in a way that seems pretty consistent from what I understand, and just, you know, having tangential knowledge of how Ponzi schemes work, is that one of the big defining aspects of any Ponzi scheme is that you always make money as an investor for the first couple months or years if you invest early enough in the scheme. And in the case of Blue Bear, the investors were being promised an annual return of 12%, which is very, very high and would normally be associated with very high risk securities. But it was being pitched to investors as a safe way to have this constant return with little to no risk for something as important as their retirement savings or their children's college fund. And the best way that Fred Joseph described it is that really these investors aren't going to come forward and bring these red flags to the attention of regulators until the scheme collapses and they start looking for someone to help them recover their money. It really feels like if you are an investor in one of these schemes and you get a call from the FBI or a securities commissioner asking about the potential red flags that they're seeing from the outside, it can be pretty easy just to say, you know, why is the government getting involved in this thing that's giving me a lot of money? And only until when the whole sandcastle gets knocked over is when you realize that. So I think the one takeaway that everyone should really know is that it's the common rule of personal finance, and it's the number one rule. If something seems too good to be true, it probably isn't.
Dan Mica and Lucas High are reporters for BizWest. You can find a link to their reporting at KUNC.org. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Henry.
Thanks.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Colorado Edition, we'll look at the sale of Fort Collins-based New Belgium Brewery. I'm Aaron O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.